to Simon.
Simon was oddly moved by the gesture. It showed a degree of respect for Simon, as an opponent and as a threat, that Simon probably didn't deserve. A lithe, muscled man with dark skin stepped out of the gate, a sword on each hip. He was followed by a tall, refined woman with feathers delicately arranged in her straight silver hair. Grandmasters Endros and Avernus. They were followed out of the gate by a handful of other Endros travelers and some troops. For a moment, Simon's hopes lifted. Maybe these were the reinforcements Indiriel had mentioned. But no. He had specifically discussed Ragnardus travelers, and Enosh had no travelers of that territory. Besides, there was no way that Enosh would work with Damasca. So what were the Grandmasters doing here? He was given his answer a moment later, when the entire party went to their knees before the incarnation, bowing with their heads almost touching the ground. Simon couldn't seem to get a breath. He had thought he was facing impossible odds when he was trying to stall the incarnation. Now, facing two Grandmasters and an entire war party from Enosh in addition to Valen. He turned and started running up the sloping wooden path. If he could get enough distance, he could open a gate and flee from here. Two black chains, like those the Nai carried, erupted from the ground on either side of the polished wooden planks. They each wrapped around one of Simon's ankles, tangling him and almost tripping him onto his face. He steadied himself, and the chains loosened enough to allow him to turn around. Valen's smile showed steadily through the night, and he waved at Simon. "Hold on a moment while I have a word with these fine ladies and gentlemen," the incarnation said. From his position on the ground, Grandmaster Endros turned his head to give Simon a blazing, hungry look. Most of the people down there would have no problem killing him, Simon knew, but Endros at least wanted his death badly. For some reason, Grandmaster Endros seemed to have a personal stake in seeing Simon dead.
"Watch out for that man," Angeline warned.
"I figured that out for myself," Simon sent.
"No need to be sarcastic," she said primly. "I get enough of that from my sisters."
Simon sank to a crouch, the chains still held loosely around his ankles. His black cloak settled around him. He let Azura and his steel both fade back into Valenhall, saving as much strength as he could. There would be a fight here, and he doubted that he had much of a chance to survive without his full strength. "Maker knows I don't have much of a chance of surviving at all," he thought. Angeline said nothing, but he felt a sense of agreement. Oddly enough, he wasn't afraid. Maybe you could only face certain death so many times before it lost its sting. "What is this?" the Valenhall incarnation asked, addressing the Enosh travelers in front of him.
"We know something of you," Grandmaster Avernus responded, raising her head a bit. "We know that none of us could stand against you."
"That's good reason for you to stay away," Valen said softly. "Not enough for you to bow."
"We have the same ambition," Avernus said in a rush. "We too wish to destroy Damasca."
"We would see Cana burn," Grandmaster Endros said. He didn't sound afraid. Valen's face twisted almost into a snarl, and he turned back to the southeast. "I'm going to Cana. If you are..." He cut off, and his head twitched to one side. "You may come with me if..." His head jerked this way and that, as though he were being pulled in two directions at once. The Enosh travelers said nothing, keeping their faces to the ground. Simon tried to stay as quiet as possible. Simon heard a whisper of cloth, and someone in a flowing black cloak stepped up beside him.
"He is at war in himself," the eldest Nai said quietly. "The man and the incarnation of our world, each with his own goals."
"What are his goals?" Simon asked, equally quiet. The last thing he wanted to do was remind anyone of his presence.
"The man, as you know, seeks the destruction of what was once his home. His reasons are personal and rooted in an ancient grief. The incarnation is a force, like heat or gravity. It tries to make this world like unto Valenhall, harsh and unforgiving, full of combat, but fair, where every man, woman, and child is tested, and everything must be earned in battle."
"Gravity," Simon thought. "What in the Maker's name is gravity?" Simon shook away the thought.
The answer didn't matter at the moment. Instead, he asked, "How do I stop him?" The eldest shrug was a rustle of cloth.
"When facing an incarnation, it is usually best to take one of two tactics. First, you can try to trick it back into its home territory, where it will be trapped. This will not work in this case, I think."
"Probably not." Valen was too smart, too in control of himself.
"The second way is to confront the incarnation with the powers of a suitable opposing territory. The Wanderer explained this to me once. An Indra's incarnation, for instance, is fueled by his rage. Asphodel, therefore, is suited for subduing Indra's, because Asphodel feeds on the target's emotions. It is much more complicated than this, of course. Some Indra's travelers have the correct powers or skills to resist Asphodel, but in general it is the other way around. Do you see?"
Simon thought he did, but he still didn't have enough information. "What opposes Valenhal?" The eldest let out a humorless, rasping chuckle.
"Valenhal," he said.
Which was no help at all.
"Valenhal is too effective at destroying foreign travelers," the eldest went on. "The incarnation can neutralize practically anything another traveler throws at him, except physical force of arms. And which territory is best at physical combat?"
Simon sighed. "I get it," he said.
"I do not wish you to die, son of Galmon, but neither can I dispute the nature of my territory. If you want to stop the Wanderer's rampage, you must earn this by force, as all things must be earned."
The eldest hesitated, adding,
"Let me give you a piece of advice. The incarnation has access to almost all the house's powers, and an unlimited supply. Good luck."
In a flutter of his black cloak, he vanished. "That is by far the most useless piece of advice I have ever received," Simon thought.
"The eldest always has a reason behind his words," Angeline corrected him. "I am sure he would not have given you advice that you couldn't use."
"Okay, then, you tell me what he means."
"I do not have the elder's wisdom," Angeline said loftily. "I couldn't begin to guess."
All this time, Valen stood muttering to himself and staring off to the southeast. The Enosh travelers and soldiers had, wisely, remained utterly silent. Finally, Valen turned back and addressed the men and women on their knees.
"Come with me if you wish," Valen said at last. "All who hate Damasca are welcome, but try to stay behind me. If you're in my way, I can't guarantee I won't kill you."
With that, he started walking away from the Enosh party, headed due southeast. His each step transformed the stones beneath his feet to polished wood. The Grandmaster stood. Endros rose to his feet like a mountain lion about to pounce, though Avernus simply stood and brushed off her dress. In voices that Simon couldn't hear well enough to understand, they began giving orders to their followers. Simon slowly slipped his feet out of the chains, which hadn't tightened again since Valen walked off. Maybe, if he moved slowly enough, he could get away and open a gate. The air here was even starting to smell more like the house, thanks to the Valenhal incarnation's influence. He started to sneak up the wooden path to the hill. Grandmaster Endros's dark eyes snapped to his, and Simon's stomach dropped. The Grandmaster drew a sword in his right hand, and his left became wreathed in a rolling thunderstorm.
"Roll right," Angeline said, and Simon dropped to his right in time to avoid a blast of white lightning that tore through the hill behind him.
Thunder crashed in his ears, and the wooden planks from Valenhal were blown to smoldering pieces. Grandmaster Endros shouted something, most likely a taunt, but Simon's ears were still ringing. Grandmaster Avernus turned and saw Endros engaging Simon in combat. She threw up her hands and left him, following the incarnation. Most of her group from Enosh followed. Not Endros, though. He stayed, holding a storm in one hand and a sword in the other.
"You don't have ghost armor, do you?" Angeline asked.
Mentally, Simon sighed.
"Why do people keep asking me that?"
"Because it's incredibly useful," she replied.
"If he hits you with a bolt of lightning as you are, the only thing you can do is die. Speaking of which, jump left."
Simon rolled left, dodging another bolt of white lightning. The lightning bolts that Enosh travelers threw seemed somehow weaker than natural lightning. The thunder when they struck wasn't as loud, for one thing, and they didn't quite blind him each time. He had seen lightning strikes before, and the ones Grandmaster Endros hurled were nothing compared to those thrown by nature. That didn't mean they wouldn't kill him, though. Just that the Grandmaster would have to hit him directly. Simon called Steel and Essence, summoning Azura. Grandmaster Endros shouted something at that, his face breaking out into an eager grin. "I can't hear you!" Simon yelled, launching himself forward. If Endros wanted a fight, he would get one. At least, that was what Simon thought at the time. "Stop!" Angeline yelled, so urgently that Simon nearly tripped over himself, drawing to a halt. Something fell from the sky so fast that it looked like a bolt of lightning itself, a gold and crimson blur that crashed into the earth like a falling star. Specifically, it crashed on top of Grandmaster Endros. The Grandmaster had enough time to raise his arms before the whatever it was crashed into him, slamming him into the ground and sending a ring of dust blasting out in all directions. The wind from the impact tore at Simon's cloak, and he raised a hand to shield his eyes from the dust. "What was that?" he asked his doll. "I'm not sure," she responded. "It was too fast before, but now, maybe a spear?" The dust cleared, and Simon saw that it was indeed a spear. A dark wood shaft stuck up from a golden steel head, with an enormous ruby set where wood and metal met. The spear had driven into the cracked ground where it had landed, and now it stuck there, quivering. Grandmaster Endros lay dirty and bleeding a pace or two behind the spear. He had managed to knock the weapon off course as it fell, though Simon couldn't imagine what kind of protection would have allowed him to do that. Endros tried to struggle to his feet, but slipped and fell back. He looked dazed as well as dirty. Boots crunched in the sand behind Simon. A lot of boots. Simon spun, sword in hand, ready to face this new threat. He found himself face to face with the king. Simon had never seen King Zachareth before, but he had heard the stories. This man, with his white hair and beard, his glowing red eye, his armor of black and gold, couldn't be anyone else. More than any one of his features, it was the way he carried himself that left no room for Simon to doubt. He inspected Simon with the sort of cold authority that Simon had always expected a king to have. Then he looked away.
"Put away your sword, Simon, son of Calmon," the king said. "You will need it no longer."
His voice held no doubt. Each of his words landed with an almost intimidating weight. Simon let Azura vanish. What else was he supposed to do? Behind Grandmaster Endros, the Valenhal incarnation and the remaining Endros travelers turned around. Valen's eyes grew so wide that Simon could see the gleaming silver from where he stood. He roared loud enough to shake the ground, raising his sword of gold and steel and rushing across the ground with the speed of the Nigh. Simon had no doubt that he was seeing Valen's true rage, the fury of a man who sought the vengeance long denied him. King Zachareth gestured, and the spear tore itself from the ground by Grandmaster Endros and flipped through the air, flying into its master's hand.
"Back up, traveler," the king snapped, and Simon instinctively ran out of his way.
Zachareth took two steps forward and, with a strength Simon wouldn't have believed he possessed, hurled the spear. The weapon left his hand with a thunderclap even louder than the lightning bolt Endros had tossed earlier. Such was the spear's speed that the air seemed to explode around it as it blasted forward, catching Valen at the level of his chest. Simon focused his Nigh essence, slowing the world enough that he could barely see what happened. He couldn't believe that even an incarnation could move so fast. As the spearhead streaked toward Valen's chest, the Wanderer brought his sword down in both hands, meeting Zachareth's spear with the edge of his dragon's fang. The world exploded in a crash of sparks and crimson light. The force tossed Simon backwards, sending yet another ring of dust blasting outward. Even the air seemed to ripple in the face of such an impact. Grandmaster Endros tumbled across the desert, driven away by the explosion. His allies from Enosh stopped, bracing themselves against the air. When the smoke cleared, the Valenhal incarnation stood still, chest heaving, holding his sword in both hands. The spear lay on the ground before him. He was obviously uninjured, glaring at King Zacharith from 50 paces away with clear malevolence in his eyes. The king motioned with one hand, and a figure in a brown cloak stepped forward. Denner. He had his red-wrapped sword in one hand, but this time he didn't hold Haruman under his other arm. What was Denner doing here? Wasn't he supposed to be defending one of the trees?
He wouldn't be here unless his orders had changed, Angeline said. Denner is very responsible. Unless he finished his task already.
Finished already? Angeline thought Denner could have traveled to one of the overlords, killed all the attackers, and hitched a ride back here all in an hour or two? How good was he? Now that he thought of it, how long had Denner been gone? Surely it had to be more than an hour. A troop of men and women marched behind Denner, each dressed in the red and gold of the king's army, with one unique exception. They all had a silvery steel badge over their chest, marked with the image of three keys, and each of them had a silver key in one hand. Travelers. They were all travelers. Simon stopped counting at 20 as they marched past him, fanning out into a crescent shape behind Denner, who stood a few steps ahead. Not all of them were from the Silver Key territory. Tartarus, he thought. A handful wore leather straps and loose tan clothing with brown hoods. Some of them had storms swirling around their hands, so Simon identified them as Endros. Two or three more wore the blood-red robes of Naraka, or the feathered head wraps of Avernus. One woman in the gray robes of another territory he wasn't sure he recognized, Asphodel, maybe, stood with a girlish smile on her face, twirling a lock of her hair around one finger. They spread out behind Denner, who stood facing his former master.
"Face us on your own," Denner called. "We will allow the travelers to retreat. Today, we only want you."
Valen's face was contorted with rage, and he didn't take his eyes off King Zacharith's face.
"You're standing up for that monster," he spat. "I expected better from you, Denner. You were worthy."
Denner sighed wearily, angling his dragon's fang up so he could scratch his back with its point.
"I only see one monster here, Master," he said. "Let the Grandmasters leave and we can fight here. It's about time we ended this."
Valen visibly struggled with himself, shudders rippling through his body, his chains swirling and crawling across his skin on their own. His eyes closed, and when they opened, the silver of his irises glowed unnaturally bright.
"Agreed," he said, his voice flat.
Mithra lowered to point at the king, and Valen's figure blurred as he rushed forward. He ran straight into a whirling thunderstorm. Grandmaster Endros had lurched to his feet, tossing his gate in front of the rampaging incarnation. The Wanderer had been sucked into Endros. Denner shouted something and leaped forward, his dragon's fang blurring and vibrating strangely in the air. Simon thought he heard the call of a distant horn. The brown-cloaked Valenhal traveler swept his blade through the gate, and it dissipated into a fine mist. Too late. Grandmaster Endros managed to slip through the gate as it closed, following the incarnation into Endros. The rest of the Enosh travelers were already piling through various other gates, each slipping back into their own territory. King Zacharith stood watching the scene, his crimson eye blazing, his face set in cold anger.
"Follow them," he commanded.
The Damascan travelers began opening gates, one by one stepping through in pursuit of the Grandmasters and the Valenhal incarnation. Denner sighed and walked over to stand by Simon, shaking his head.
"We won't catch them. Even if we do, Valen's just as deadly in a foreign territory as he is here."
"I know that better than most," the king said softly.
He raised one hand, and his spear tore itself from the ground and flew back to smack into his gauntleted palm.
"We have lost nothing here. We will simply return to our previous strategy, gather everything we have outside of Enosh, and crush them in a single blow."
He didn't sound angry, excited, or determined at the prospect of finally destroying his enemies. He didn't sound emotional at all. He sounded as though he were simply stating facts. He would gather his forces, they would annihilate Enosh. There was no possibility for failure. Simon shivered. It was difficult not to believe King Zachareth when he spoke like that.
"Excuse me, Your Highness," Denner said. "I'm sorry, but why haven't we destroyed Enosh before? Why wait until now when they have an incarnation on their side?"
"Until recently, it was more profitable leaving Enosh intact," the king said flatly. "Leah, explain."
A woman's voice spoke up from behind Simon. "Even when they opposed us, Enosh travelers still helped to secure their territories. They kept the wild elements down, and they maintained roads and way stations. We even traded with them occasionally. In all, it was far more efficient having them around, at least until they got too aggressive." At the sound of her voice, Simon stiffened and slowly turned around. He knew that voice. He knew her. He stared straight at her, but his mind refused to accept what he saw. The king noticed. He spread his hand to the left, where stood a tall man with curly golden hair like Alan's, wearing an expensive suit of black and red.
"My son, Heir Talos," Zachareth said.
But Simon was having a much more difficult time taking his eyes off the young woman to his right. She was dressed in a long dress of pure red. A circlet of silvered steel rested in her hair, shining with an unnatural red glare and set with a small ruby. On her left wrist, she wore a milky white crystal hanging by a silver chain, and her eyes were surprisingly blue. She stared back at him, her face totally blank. King Zachareth motioned to the right with his spear.
"And I believe you know my daughter, Heiress Leah."
His words were casual, but his tone wasn't. Both his eyes were focused on Simon's face, his expression as warm as an executioner's axe. Simon barely noticed. He couldn't take his eyes from Leah. He didn't know what to say.
Chapter 13. Nine Doors. Alan followed Ralia deeper into the city of Elysia. Once past the walls, the tunnel opened up into a wide street, paved with flawless white stone. The buildings on either side were built of gold and gold-colored stone, with doors of various different colors. Ralia had explained the significance of the colors to him before. They had something to do with each building's purpose, like hanging a sign. But he was so exhausted now that he could barely see straight. This particular section of the city was in the Gold District, which explained the general theme of the buildings. Supposedly, in other districts, buildings were made up of many different materials and colors, but here they all shared a certain similarity. Since Alan had only demonstrated two of Elysia's nine virtues, and therefore only earned two of its powers, he was only allowed in two districts. Well, he still wasn't quite patient enough to deserve the green, but Ralia had been willing to let that slide. He was confident he'd get there, eventually. The Green District had very few buildings at all. It was mostly a wild forest, with trees that stretched so high they rivaled the highest towers of the Gold and Silver Districts. Where a home or other building was needed in the Green, a living tree was hollowed out, through some method that Alan didn't understand, in such a way that the tree actually kept growing. As he understood it, the process took years. Alan, Ralia, and the floating Grandmaster were not the only ones on the street. A gold-skinned giant warrior, with a solid gold walking staff, stopped and bowed as Alan and Ralia passed. A flock of shimmering golden hummingbirds stopped and asked, in their deceptively deep voices, whether they could be of any assistance. As they passed an open door, Alan thought he saw a brown-furred cat with a golden collar, standing on her hind legs at a table. She was using a knife and fork to carve slices from a roasted bird, which she passed out to her four hungry children. Alan had never learned how to tell time here. The sky was always gold, though it dimmed or brightened at seemingly random times. Some times in the city were busier than others, he knew that, because sometimes he walked through the streets and remained virtually alone. He had once wondered what possessing a particular virtue had to do with walking down the streets of the city. Why should he have to prove himself particularly brave to travel the Gold District, for instance? Why would patience be of such great value in the Green District? He had soon learned the answer. A creature that looked like a man about Alan's size stepped in front of Alan. He wore white baggy clothing, belted with a golden sash, and carried a gold walking stick,
a miniature version of the one that the gold-skinned giants carried. The man would not have been too out of place on the streets of Enosh, except that he had the head of a gray wolf.
"Traveler," the wolf said, bowing fractionally.
He had the sort of vicious, slobbery voice that suggested he was shredding each word between his teeth.
"Marikos," Alan said, bowing back.
He had run into the wolfman before, and he was always scrupulously polite, and equally violent.
"I take this time to request a match, traveler," Marikos said.
His yellow-gold predator's eyes gleamed.
"Not today, Marikos, I beg you," Alan said wearily. "I have an injured companion."
"I shall not delay you long," Marikos promised.
He placed his hand, which looked relatively ordinary except for the claws where fingernails should be, on Alan's shoulder. Ralia twisted in midair and smiled in the wolf's direction.
"Sorry, Marikos, no time today, but he'll make it up to you tomorrow, won't you, Alan?"
Alan hastily agreed, but Marikos didn't quite take his hand away. He was trying to decide whether Alan was showing appropriate valor by tending to his wounded comrade, even though he was running away. Or maybe he was trying to decide if letting Alan leave was a matter of cowardice. Alan wasn't sure, but he knew that they took courage very seriously here. The wolfman's nostrils flared as if he were trying to smell Alan's fear.
"Marikos," Ralia sang sweetly, "we need to move. If you keep us here, you will be impeding me, and then I would have to call for a duel. Let's not do that, shall we?"
Marikos pulled his claws away from Alan's shoulder as though Alan's armor had grown red hot.
"I apologize sincerely, Ralia. I certainly have no wish to unduly impede you. Until tomorrow, traveler."
Marikos put distance between himself and the drifting, white-clothed woman with deceptive speed, considering that he stopped to bow every 2 paces. Alan stared at Ralia, who had spun back around and continued guiding Grandmaster Naraka's floating body down the street.
"What was that about?" Alan asked.
Ralia waved a hand airily.
"Oh, Marikos is a child, scarcely 50. He can barely go a day without proving his valor to somebody, but he'll grow out of it eventually."
"Not him," Alan said. "You. Are you that frightening?"
She smiled, but she didn't look him in the eye when she did.
"I've never done anything to frighten Marikos. He listens to stories, that's all."
"What stories?"
She looked at him, her face as serious as he had ever seen it.
"Maybe I'll tell you one day," she said.
He let the matter drop. After a few more minutes and a few more exchanges with the Gold District's inhabitants, none of which grew as dramatic as their confrontation with Marikos, the three of them finally reached the end of the street. A huge wall marked the end of the Gold District in this direction. According to Ralia, the wall wound its way throughout the entire city, separating each district. Alan had once visualized the City of Light as laid out in 9 equal wedges, one for each color and virtue. But Ralia had assured him that was not the case. The Gold District was thin but long, winding around and touching the outer wall at most major points. The Green District was wide and round, like a park in the center of the city. Other districts had more or less space, depending on the needs of the occupants. And there were occupants. The city was much busier than Alan had once assumed. Elysia had continued to bustle with life, even after the last traveler vanished, faded, or died. Ralia was remarkably close-mouthed regarding what had happened to the last of the Elysian travelers, but the fact remained that they had somehow disappeared. The City of Light had not seen a traveler for over 350 years, so Alan's arrival had been something to celebrate. Not that the Gold District celebrated the same as the people of Enosh, he had found out. Much less feasting, and much more challenging one another to feats of strength and bravery. In the wall at the end of the Gold District was a man-sized door of solid gold, marked with the same winged sword design that adorned Alan's breastplate. Ralia didn't hesitate when she reached the door, placing her hand on the center and simply pushing it in. Grandmaster Naraka followed, still unconscious, still floating on the bed of orange light.
"Is she going to survive until we get where we're going?" Alan asked at last. He would have brought the topic up before, but he had tried to assume that Ralia knew what she was doing.
Oh, I've stabilized her already, Ralia said. She'll not lose any more ground, at least not while she's with me. Whether she will regain the ground that she's lost, however, is up to you.
They entered a circular chamber that Alan had only seen a few times before. It was only 10 steps by 10, but Ralia said this was the true heart of the city. Set in the wall around the room, every few paces, were doors. A painted wooden door of bright green marked the entrance to the Green District. He had entered through the door to the Gold District. Opposite him, a similar door, apparently made of solid silver and carved with fanciful spirals and designs, would take him to the Silver District. Doors all around the wall led to the other districts: red, rose, orange, violet, blue, and white. The doors all varied in size and material. The White District door was the smallest, and it looked as though he would have to duck and turn sideways to squeeze his way through. The Red District door was by far the widest, and looked as though it had been built to accommodate wagons. Ralia led him to the Rose District door, which was made of some soft-smelling reddish-pink wood. The symbol of Elysia, which was carved into each of the doors, looked somehow less sharp here, as though it were actually a winged staff or a scepter instead of a sword. "Behind each of these doors is another district of the city," Ralia said. "You are only worthy to visit two of them, though I have high hopes regarding the other seven." Alan couldn't help himself. His gaze moved hungrily from one door to another. What powers waited behind each door? If he was this powerful with only two of Elysia's abilities, what would he become if he held all nine? What greater things could he accomplish? The side of Ralia's mouth quirked up as though she could read his mind.
"Oh, we've got many powers here," she said. "Elysia was meant to lead each territory by example, so there are powers here in line with each of the nine territories. You open the orange door by demonstrating exceptional loyalty, for instance, which is a virtue highly valued in Avernus. In the Orange District, you may earn powers such as levitation and flight, which you have already seen demonstrated." She nodded to Grandmaster and her example. "So there are powers here in line with each of the nine territories. You open the orange door by demonstrating exceptional loyalty, for instance, which is a virtue highly valued in Avernus. In the Orange District, you may earn powers such as levitation and flight, which you have already seen demonstrated." She nodded to Grandmaster Naraka, buoyed on cushions of glowing orange lights. "The Blue District exemplifies mercy," Ralia continued, "a quality necessary to the Naraka travelers, who tend to be judgmental. Wisdom is the virtue most necessary in the Silver District, though it would certainly benefit you elsewhere. And within here," she placed a hand on the Rose District door, "is the power of healing. Tell me, Alan, why do you want to heal this woman?"
"Because she's injured," Alan said without hesitation. "She was hurt while she was with me, and I couldn't protect her. And she's a friend. Why shouldn't I help her?"
Ralia actually pulled the Rose District door open and stuck her head inside, though the door itself blocked the district from Alan's view.
"What do you think?" Ralia asked someone beyond the door. "Good enough?"
An indistinct voice, like a child's whisper, murmured something in reply.
"That's what I thought, too," Ralia responded.
She stepped back into the room, letting the rose-colored door shut behind her. At Alan's questioning look, she held up a hand parallel to the ground and moved it back and forth.
Not bad. We'll work on it. For now, though, your motives are pure enough. Welcome to the Rose District."
Ralia drifted through the open door, followed by the prone form of Grandmaster Naraka. Alan lingered behind, testing the nearest door, the red one, by twisting the knob and pulling just a bit. It opened easily. Through the crack, Alan saw a rocky landscape of winding paths, and what he thought was a red stone building carved to look like a mushroom. Something like a little, knee-high man in a floppy red cap scurried by, holding up his long white beard to keep it out of the mud. Ralia popped back into the room, saw what he was doing, and sighed good-naturedly.
"I can't keep you from going where you're not supposed to, can I?" she said.
Alan gestured to the door.
"But I can open it. Look!"
"Of course you can," she said. "The doors aren't locked."
"Oh."
That was disappointing, somehow.
Ralia floated over to him, placing her hands on his shoulders companionably.
"Listen,
I don't try and keep you from these districts because you can't enter, but because you shouldn't enter. It's not that we require you to show a particular virtue before we allow you to use a power. It's more like you need a particular virtue to handle that power. The gold power is for battle, for instance, and we wouldn't want anyone in battle who wasn't brave. Likewise, patient people make good defenders. Do you see? It seemed like a pretty weak thread to Alan.
What happens if I don't have the virtue? What if I walked through this door?
This particular door? Well, the gnomes who live on the other side would likely beat you and toss you back out, Ralya said. But in general, we don't stop people from taking power they think they've earned. We're trying to help you make the right choices, not make them for you. But eventually, if you take too much power too quickly, you stop controlling the power, and it starts controlling you.
Ralya's voice became distant and more serious at the end, as though she were reliving a particularly unpleasant memory.
What does that mean? Alan asked.
You become an incarnation, Ralya said, still distant. Little more than an embodiment of your territory's nature and power.
That doesn't sound too bad, Alan responded. The incarnation of patience and mercy and all that.
Ralya raised a hand to her forehead. We didn't think so either, once, she said.
Then she shook herself and smiled at him.
Anyway, you're gathering powers pretty quickly yourself, especially if I decide to grant you permanent access to the Rose, which I have not decided yet. You have to be careful.
Alan nodded. He certainly had no wish to risk going insane, and if Ralya thought the danger was so great, he was sure she knew what she was talking about. As they walked into the Rose District, Alan nodded to the small white door.
What about that one? Alan asked. I've heard you mention the other colors, but I've never heard you talk about the white.
Ralya laughed.
Still curious, are you? The white's something of a special case. It is linked to Ragnaros, the Crimson Vault. Just as Ragnaros promotes sacrifice, the White District requires you to demonstrate the attendant virtue. It's the opposite of Ragnaros, the one virtue required to use the Vault's weapons with wisdom and discipline.
What's that? Alan asked.
Selflessness, she responded. Self-sacrifice. Ragnaros travelers have an unfortunate tendency to pay their prices using other people. If a weapon activates using pain, for instance, why not torture one of your enemies until your weapon drinks its fill? Why not bleed a peasant dry to use a sword that drinks blood?
Or kill your citizens to keep your tree growing, Alan said.
Precisely.
I'm not sure what good the white power would do, though, Alan noted. Especially not if you have to sacrifice yourself to use it.
Ralya shrugged.
No, it's not like that. Self-sacrifice is more often the practice of thinking of others first. You don't have to necessarily give up your life. In the old days, some of the greatest masters of the White sacrificed their time, their money, or their freedom for others. Selflessness is basically the keystone to all our virtues here.
Alan looked at the white door for a moment longer before he headed into the Rose District, his questions, for now, answered. No matter what Ralya said, Alan thought he would save the white door for last. Simon said nothing, moving his gaze from Leah to the king and back. Part of his mind had frozen from shock, but the part that still worked noted that this actually explained quite a bit. The king's blue eye was cold.
I'm sure you have a lot to catch up on, he said. Before I leave you to discuss whatever you must discuss, you should hear my words. You are a wanted criminal in my lands.
Simon jerked his head back to look King Zacharith in the face. He was less surprised by the announcement than he was by the fact that the king himself knew what he had done.
Zacharith misinterpreted his reaction. Surprised? You shouldn't be. You killed 53 of my subjects that I am aware of. In another situation, I would have you bound and executed.
If anyone makes a move, I will warn you, Angeline sent. Be prepared to run.
For once, Simon was glad that he was carrying a serious and straightforward doll instead of one prone to making jokes.
I am prepared to grant you mercy, however, the king went on.
His eyes, blazing red and ice-cold blue, looked anything but merciful.
Serve me in protecting my realm, and I will commute your sentence until such a time as we are prepared to judge you for your actions. If you wish leniency, I suggest you dedicate your life to the service of my kingdom.
He stared at Simon with those disconcerting eyes, obviously expecting a response.
Yes, Your Highness, Simon said at last, dropping his gaze to the ground.
He had considered any number of other reactions, but what else was one supposed to say to the king? King Zachareth turned as though the matter was fully dealt with, not acknowledging Simon's response in any way. He walked away, already deep in conversation with his son. The heir turned and regarded Simon once before he walked off, his expression thoughtful, but he ultimately said nothing. Denner and the other travelers behind him were wrapped up in their own conversation, one that sounded to Simon like strategic planning. As everyone else pulled away, Leah stayed behind. For a handful of seconds, she stayed silent.
So, Simon said at last, you're a princess.
No, I'm an heiress. Nobody says princess anymore except in children's tales.
She sounded nervous more than anything, which meant that she was trying to divert his attention. Simon refused to be put off.
So, he said, you're an heiress.
I'm King Zachareth's fourth child, yes, Leah said loftily.
She was looking at him, but her face was still blank. She was keeping her mask on, so Simon kept his face still as well. He couldn't keep a bit of anger from leaking into his voice, though.
What does that mean? He demanded.
Does that mean you're fourth in line for the throne?
To her credit, Leah hesitated a moment before saying,
Second, actually. It's a bit more complicated than that, but my two older sisters were disqualified from the succession. One of them is insane, and the other was recently exiled to Lyriel. And my younger brother is dead. It's just me and my oldest brother left now.
Second. Second in line for the throne of Damascus. Simon tried to force words out past the emotion in his throat, tried to give voice to everything he was thinking, but all that came out was,
We rescued you.
Leah looked past him, but her mask stayed on.
I was never in any danger from Malachi, she said.
A horrible realization dawned on Simon.
It was you. You were the reason that the sacrifice came to Myria. You're why all those people are dead.
Depending on her answer, Simon was quite prepared to summon Azura and cut her down in the street, even if he would not survive her long.
Quickly she said, No, no, I had no idea Malachi would call the sacrifice in Myria. That's the first time he's ever taken all 9 sacrifices from one small village. When I found out he had done it, I was furious.
Simon wasn't sure that made her deception any better, but he found his violent fury fading. But something still didn't make sense.
Why were you in the village at all? He asked.
Maker, you could have lived your life in a palace. You probably grew up there. The situation got worse and worse the more he thought about it.
What must she have thought of them, living in houses of mud bricks and scrap wood?
She must have been laughing behind their backs every time they turned around. Leah looked into Simon's eyes carefully, as though trying to reassure herself that he wasn't going to attack. She sighed and grabbed him by the sleeve, leading him over to a pair of benches among the soldiers' camp. The presence of the Valinol incarnation had caused the benches to fuse to the ground, now permanent fixtures of the hilltop, but they faced one another. Leah sat down on one and motioned imperiously for him to take the second. Simon sat, feeling like an idiot. How had he not noticed? She had certainly acted like a princess or an heiress, he supposed. Often enough, giving people orders and expecting them followed on the instant. Come to think of it, though, her aunt Nurita behaved that way as well, and she had lived in Myria all her life. Wait.
Maker, he thought. Is she royalty, too?
He had taken so many assumptions for granted, and was finally coming face to face with reality.
Every heir and heiress, Leah began,
is expected to spend an extended period of time outside of the palace. In some cases, that means a handful of months. In others, it can be as long as 5 years. The specifics depend on the individual and the needs of the realm. The specifics depend on the individual. Who talked like that? Alan, when he was giving a speech, but no other villager Simon had ever met. How had he never noticed? To cover his thoughts, Simon asked a question. They let members of the royal family just go off like that, unsupervised? What if you were killed? What if someone found out who you were and kidnapped you? She waved that thought away with one hand. We were required to check in on a regular basis through Ragnaros. If I missed a check-in, travelers would have been at my location in a matter of hours. Even if I did die, this is a family tradition. My father believes that no one can be an effective ruler unless they have lived through an especially long and difficult trial. Besides, I know it may be difficult for you to get used to the idea, but I am a powerful traveler myself. Killing or kidnapping me would be harder than it seems. Simon wished he had known that at Midsummer, when he had risked his life again and again to bring her out of danger. In my case, Leah continued, I was sent to Myria to connect with my mother's family, to learn how my ancestors lived. Yes, my mother really did come from Myria. Yes, Aunt Nerita was her sister. For what it's worth, I was honest about that. Assuming I can trust you now, Simon thought. He still only had her word to go on. I would say she's speaking the truth, Angeline said carefully. Simon had forgotten he was carrying the doll. He picked her up and looked at her curiously. Can you sense when someone is lying? He wouldn't be surprised if she could. No, Angeline said, but I have a great deal of experience with liars, and this girl sounds genuine to me. Simon considered that for a moment. As much as he was curious about what Angeline meant about experience, he felt better. If Angeline could vouch for Leah, he would accept that. For now. Leah watched him raise the doll to his face and place it back down. She didn't say a word. This is my advisor, Simon explained. One of them. From my territory. I had assumed something like that, Leah said evenly. If I may continue. She was admitting to spending years lying to the people closest to her, and somehow she could still make him feel bad for interrupting. Spending time with my mother's family was one reason. Learning about the common villagers was another. One can learn a surprising amount about governing even outside the royal palace. But I had another purpose, a deeper purpose, even if I didn't expect ever to accomplish it. We received word from one of our Strigaia tribe Avernus travelers that the Enosh grandmasters thought the bloodline of Elysia was continued in one of the villages. Since Myria was the closest village to Enosh, it was reasonable, based on the information we had, to suspect that the new Elysian traveler might come from your village. Alan. Somehow, it always came back to Alan. Understand, though, that the odds were greatly against me. There are over 100 small, isolated villages at the fringes of our nation, and I was only to stay a limited time. I identified Alan as the most likely subject, given his lineage, and I kept an eye on him. How long ago? Simon asked. Leah shrugged. Over 2 years ago, when I first entered the village. It took me a matter of hours. But after observing him for a few weeks, then months, I was certain that he was not the one. He never exhibited any strange powers, never snuck off to Enosh for a secret rendezvous, never received any mysterious visitors. When I ruled him out, I knew that the odds of me finding the Elysian traveler in Myria were minimal, so I simply kept my ear to the ground, so to speak, and lived my life. Of course he never did any of those things, Simon said. He didn't know he was a traveler. Leah sighed. Yes, Simon, I know that now. But you have to understand, that's not how any of the other territories work. For every other territory I know of, even for Valenhall, I understand, though you would know more about that than I. You have to intentionally walk through a gate to that territory, earn some kind of artifact, power, or ally on the other side, and then return. It's not something you can do accidentally or unaware. Except, in the case of Elysia, it seems you can.
Simon sat in silence, thinking, chewing on the information she had given him. Eventually, Leah kept talking.
There's not much else that you don't know or haven't guessed. When the Damascan troops came to Myria, I was furious. They were interfering with my trial, and with my officially sanctioned mission to locate the potential Elysian traveler. When I left you, I spoke with the man in charge, and I tried to get them to leave immediately. But Cormac, the Andros traveler...
I remember, Simon interrupted. His voice went flat, and anger surged once again in his chest. He desperately hoped that she didn't have anything to do with sending Cormac into that cave, because if she was responsible for the death of his mother... He didn't know what the penalty was for killing a member of the Damascan royal family, but he would do his best to find out. Leah eyed him, and for a moment sympathy cracked through her blank mask.
Yes. Yes, I'm sure you would. Well, he was unstable. I would almost call him a madman, except that every traveler is usually broken in some way. It has to do with the stress of living alongside worlds so wholly unlike our own. He insisted on checking the survivors, on making sure that there were no Enosh agents among you. He was only supposed to scare you, Simon. I swear it.
Simon stared at Leah, giving her no indication of what he was thinking. He wasn't sure he even knew.
When he killed Orlena, I almost stopped him. Then Alan revealed himself, and all I remember thinking was that I had failed. I had come that far, spent 2 years of my life, and he had been right under my nose the entire time.
Why didn't you show yourself then? Simon asked. You could have stopped Cormac. You two would have taken Alan. My mother would have... He stopped. He didn't trust himself to keep talking. Leah's mask crumbled a little further. She almost looked pained.
I wasn't sure what to do, Simon. I'm sorry.
To tell you the truth, I thought about it. I didn't know which side I should support. Cormac was insane, true, but he was also the legally appointed representative of Damascus. I didn't know the extent of Alan's abilities. I've heard legends of Elysian travelers all my life. As far as I knew, he would be able to kill me and Cormac without breaking a sweat. I simply didn't know. I was worried that Enosh might have travelers in the area, so I was afraid to reveal myself, and, as it turned out, they did.
That all sounded good. It was a better reason than Simon had imagined. But the fact remained that she could have saved Simon's mother, but she had chosen not to.
She would have been captured or killed, Simon told himself. But that didn't matter. He found it hard to defend, even to himself, a girl who had spent the last 2 years lying to him. Abruptly, Simon stood and walked past Leah, summoning Azura as he walked. Three Tartarus travelers, who had been lounging nearby, stiffened and focused their eyes on Simon, silver keys in hand. Maker. They hadn't left her alone with him at all. They had been watching him the entire time. That stoked his anger even hotter.
Where are you going, Simon? Leah asked. She sounded calm, not curious.
Simon stuck his sword in the air and began slicing through reality.
Valenhall gates only go in one direction, he responded. I'm tired. I'm hungry. I took a beating today from an insane incarnation with powers beyond mortal imagination. I need a little time off.
I thought we should talk a little more, Leah said gently.
And that was about all Simon could take of the I'm an heiress condescension. Without moving Azura, he turned around so that he could look Leah in the eye.
I'm not one of your subjects, Your Highness. I don't owe you a thing. In fact, the way I see it, the scales are tipping way toward my side now.
Leah raised one eyebrow and opened her mouth to respond. Whatever she said would probably be way wittier and far more reasonable than anything he could come up with, so he cut her off.
Don't. I've listened to you long enough.
Then he realized something he had said only a day or two ago. It seemed ironic and twisted to him now.
Maker, I said it myself, didn't I? I said that I wanted to know the real you. I asked for this.
Simon shook his head, turning back to the gate.
I take it back.
Simon shut up before he said something he would really regret, or something that would draw the attention of Leah's red-eyed father and his fast-as-lightning spear. Full of nauseating, unpleasant emotions, and bleeding or aching at every point on his body, Simon stepped through the Valenhall gate and went home. Leah sat on the wooden bench for longer than she probably should have, thinking up all the clever things that she should have said. They all, for some reason, centered on her superior education or superior upbringing or superior experience. For a moment, she wished she were back in the village, where they were both on equal footing. That was foolish, but she couldn't help it. The real problem was that he had a right to be angry. It burned her to admit it, but she would have felt the same in his situation. "You were prepared for this," she told herself. "That's the price of a long-term mission. You have to lie to everyone." It was true. She had thought herself prepared. Her brothers and sisters had lied to her and tried to manipulate her since before she was old enough to read, and she was expected to do the same. That was how life was. Except in Myria, it wasn't. Simon was the same person to her as he was to Alan, or to any of the others in the village. He had risked his life on a quest that he thought would save her, with nothing to gain. Alan had also tried to save her, that was true, but Alan she could understand. He craved the light. He wanted recognition, hers in particular. She understood that and could even respect it to a degree. At least he worked hard to earn his good reputation. But Simon? Simon had worked for months to save people with no connection, with no possibility of reward. And she had played him, like a piece on a board. Once, that thought wouldn't have bothered her. She had grown up knowing that she had to be in control, that it was her duty to direct the lives of others. Now, though, it ate at her inside. She had hoped to keep her identity secret as long as she could, maybe faking her death to escape from Enosh. Now that was no longer an option, so was there any way she could repair her relationship with Simon? Maybe she could make him understand her motivations. Surely he would understand if she simply explained. No, he was the type who would appreciate action. Perhaps she could do something to show him that she wasn't so bad after all, that she did have a life outside her family's lies. Leah was surprised to realize that she even cared. Chapter 14, The Frozen Horn. 358th year of the Damascan calendar, 24th year in the reign of King Zacharath VI, 32 days after Midsummer. 13 days until summer's end. Simon left his cloak behind as he walked through the stone door to the rain garden. He carried Kayla and Azura together, one in each hand, and stared ahead at the lush, leafy greenery that awaited him. He had been healed completely by the pool, and he had spent most of the time after his battle with Valen wandering mindlessly around the house. He had barely seen any of the Agnos family in the day or two since he had arrived. He saw one glimpse of Andra, waving to him from down a hallway, before she scurried into a bedroom and vanished. Simon wasn't entirely sure how they could all hide from him, since the house, while incomprehensibly vast, only had a handful of rooms that they could all enter. But it seemed they had found the few rooms where they could go and Simon could not. That meant he had a lot of time to think. Mostly he thought about the upcoming battle and what his role was supposed to be. He had seen Indiriel briefly, hobbling down the hall to take another dip in the healing pool. "You did a good job," Indiriel had said. "We'll need you in what's coming." Then he had disappeared into the bathroom. The pool had been unable to heal all his internal injuries with only one session, so the Overlord came back for several baths per day. But he spent the rest of his time outside the territory, meeting with the king, organizing the Damascan War. Once again, Simon saw Valen's attack in his mind's eye. Indiriel had fought the incarnation evenly for a while, and afterwards even managed to injure him. What had Simon done? Distracted him at best. Simon took a deep breath of the rain garden's humid air and leaned down, placing Kayla on the stone tiles at the base of the door. She didn't say a word. Stepping forward onto the grass, he leaned his weight forward, crouching on the balls of his feet,
and angled Azura to match the gap in the eternally drumming rain. When the dead space abruptly shifted ahead, he moved with it. Simon stepped forward, falling into the next stance. Azura's tip sliced a petal off a nearby flower, but since it didn't disturb the rain, Simon barely noticed. Alan had found his place, working for Enosh. They had practically conscripted him, but he seemed happy there, and Simon didn't blame him. Leah had a family and a place in Damasca, a rich, powerful, and successful place, in a position of great authority, which still seemed somehow unfair to Simon. He still thought of Leah as another villager, and no matter how he tried to remind himself that she had been born into her status, he still remained somehow unconvinced. Leah and Alan had their places, and Simon would stand against Valen again, he knew that. The other Valenhall travelers would expect him to be there, and would likely want his help. What was he supposed to do? Should he repeat his fight with Valen, distracting the incarnation, trying desperately not to die, until one of the real travelers managed to land the killing blow? Simon stepped forward, thrusting his blade into an invisible opponent. The cold steel trickled through him, lending him the strength to wave Azura around so easily. But he needed a new power. He needed a lot more than that, really. He needed something to fight for, some other clear villain that he could hate and work against without guilt. He wasn't the biggest supporter of the Grandmasters, but his time in Enosh had convinced him that they truly believed Damasca was killing the world, as well as driving their people with tyranny and cruelty. He couldn't bring himself to hate the Grandmasters. They thought they were doing the right thing, after all. On the Damascan side, Indiriel didn't seem like such a bad guy, and Simon couldn't even blame their annual sacrifice now that he had seen what the hanging trees were supposed to hold back. Simon imagined 9 other incarnations, all at least as powerful as Valen, and he shuddered so hard that he almost missed the next step forward. No matter how strong Valen was, he was still one man with a sword. The amount of damage he could cause was somewhat limited. But one of the other incarnations would summon monsters from their territory, an army of monsters, and they would shred the countryside like a swarm of locusts. If they had to face an incarnation, Simon was glad it was Valen. At least he could be fought. Simon's sword forms took him through to another thrust, and he remembered Indiriel's sword piercing Valen's chest. For a second, he had been sure they had won. If they couldn't kill Valen, even with a sword through the heart, how were they supposed to put him down? He found himself mimicking Indiriel's strike as he imagined it, and as a result, he fell slightly out of form. His sword extended a tad too far, and a single raindrop hit the tip with an audible ping. Without even looking around, Simon called the breath of the Nigh into his lungs. The world slowed as the rain began to stop, and he ran back to the entrance with speed that a startled deer might have envied. Behind him, he heard the smooth rush of the water drawing itself up into 1,000 long-necked, long-fanged cats. This time, Simon reached the stone platform before the cats did, and he was far enough away that when he spun around to watch, he saw all the cats dissolving back into puddles. Simon raised his hands and shouted in triumph, Azura waving like a flagpole into the cloud-covered sky. The sword's tip actually brushed the bottom of a cloud, which made Simon realize that the clouds were only about 15 feet up. The tops of some of the rain garden trees disappeared into the clouds,